Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk Eva Talk here. What I'll be talking about today is the relationship between what's called the loop-corrected soft photon theorem and the large gauge transformations. So this is a work in progress with Alok Lada and Andrea Poom. This is something that we've been thinking about in the last couple of years, and we are getting to the end of it. So I'll talk about what we have developed so far, and then what are the shortcomings of our approach. So let's step back a bit and talk about soft theorems. So soft theorem is a statement in quantum field theory that relates the amplitudes of an external photon, an amplitude with an external photon, to those without an external photon in the soft, in the zero energy limit. So, or precisely, if you have a diagram, maybe I can use the mouse. If you have a diagram like this with an external photon, momentum k, and take the limit as k goes to zero, then what soft theorem tells us is that in that limit, this amplitude is proportional to the Feynman diagram that doesn't have the external photon. So in equations, you can write it like this. The amplitude with a photon of polarization plus or minus with energy k in the limit where the energy goes to zero takes the following form. So you can write it in power loss series. The leading term is of order 1 over the energy, which is divergent in this limit. The subleading term is independent of the energy, and therefore is convergent. And then, and then it goes on. And then the whole factor multiplies the amplitude without the external photon. So in QED, for instance, the leading factor takes the following form. So the 1 over energy comes from the energy k sitting in the denominator. Epsilon here is the polarization tensor of the photon. Q is the charge. So this form of the soft, the leading soft photon theorem is universal. No matter what theory of electrodynamics you bring in, no matter what higher order corrections you give to it, those do not affect this leading order soft factor. The subleading term is valid at tree level. This is usually called Lowe's subleading soft theorem. Now, this involves the angular momentum operator, right, where there's the orbital angular momentum and then the spin part. And it also has to do with a similar structure. There's the charge, the polarization tensor, and now we have the photon energy in the denominator and the numerator. So in terms of the energy of the soft photon, this factor is independent. Now, this structure also holds for leading and subleading soft graviton theorems, soft gluon theorems. It works with supersymmetry soft Fotino theorems. It works in higher dimensions, and so on. I want to relate those soft theorems with what is called an asymptotic symmetry. So what is an asymptotic symmetry? A convenient way of thinking about asymptotic symmetries is that it's the set of allowed gauge symmetry modded out by the trivial gauge symmetries. And by trivial, I mean the redundancies of the description. And of course, this is a convenient way to think about it. There are exceptions to it. But I won't talk about those in this talk. And if you look at this, you may ask the question, like, well, gauge symmetries, aren't they all trivial? Like, what do you mean by allowed and what do you mean by trivial? Actually, that's not true. If you follow the Noether procedure and compute the generator of a local gauge symmetry, then you notice that in order for the generator to be zero on shell, there is a fall-off condition on the gauge parameter. And also, there in the theory, there are usually fall-off conditions for the fields. And those two conditions don't agree. There's a gap between the fall-off conditions on the fields and the follow-up conditions for the gauge symmetry to be trivial. And whatever fall-offs of the fields that fit in between this gap forms the group of asymptotic symmetries. So in this sense, the asymptotic symmetry group is referred to as the large gauge transformations. This terminology is used in other contexts, which has to do with non-trivial topological sectors of the theory. But this definition allows for topologically trivial large gauge transformations as well. But it's in the same similar spirit, in the sense that gauge transformations can be non-trivial. In some contexts, this is referred to as improper gauge transformations, as opposed to proper gauge transformations that are really the redundancies in the description. In this talk, I'll be talking mostly about QED in flat background. So here is a Penrose diagram of Minkowski spacetime. There's some notations that I'll be using in this talk. Scribe plus will denote the entire future null infinity, and scribe plus plus and plus minus will be used to denote the future and the past boundary of this null infinity. And then I plus I'll use to refer to the future time-like infinity, where massive particles go to at large times.
I don't think you need to call
Yes? Oh, yeah, so...
If you've had someone just literally take images from your slides, though...
So, yeah, so I don't mean Strominger invented this. What I mean is that...
From a paper, come on, this is square.
Right. fair point, yes.
Like, it's actually like for our
I copy pasted and had a little conscience problem to put his name there, but that's a fair point, yeah. Okay, so in QED, what is the asymptotic symmetry of QED? So it's the set of gauge transformations, but they shouldn't be redundancies of the theory. So the condition here is that the gauge parameter doesn't vanish at infinity. And if you just follow the usual Noether procedure to compute the charges, what you'll find is that if the parameter doesn't vanish at infinity, you can write them as integrals on a circle at infinity that doesn't vanish on shell. So these transformations are physical. Yes, I heard a question. Was there a question? No? Okay. So these asymptotic symmetries are symmetries of the S matrix. And what I mean by this is that if you take the generator and commute it with the scattering matrix, and then sandwich that commutator between scattering states, then that resulting expression is zero. And by a commutator, I mean, QS minus SQ. And this equation is usually referred to as the word identity of the asymptotic symmetry generator. And this has a lot to do with the soft theorem that we saw earlier. This word identity has been shown to be equivalent to the soft theorems in many examples. So the large gauge transformations in QED, this is just a way to rewrite the leading soft photon theorem. And likewise, in gravity, the BMS supertranslations, if you look at its word identities, it is equivalent to the leading soft graviton theorem. Now, if you take BMS superrotations, these are the word identities equivalent to the subleading soft graviton theorem at tree level. Now in QED, what corresponds to the superrotations is the set of large gauge transformations, but now the gauge parameter is not only non-zero at infinity, it diverges. And if you take that divergent large gauge transformations, you can show that it is equivalent to the subleading soft photon theorem at tree level.
So can you comment on that more?
Yes.
Is it actually the like does it help you know, your money or whatever you're adding and just like growing in R?
Yeah. So there's a specific condition on how much it should diverge. So it should diverge linearly in R. And this works, this is known to work only in harmonic gauge. If you go to other gauges.
Because the question is, like, why would it only be true level if there's actually a symmetry associated with it?
So it is divergent, but if you look at the computations of the original authors, Kempegi and Nada, what they do is you look at the generator, there's a divergent part to it, which is actually proportional to the this charge, the large gauge transformation, the convergent charge. Yeah, so what they say is, well, we know that this charge already forms the leading soft theorem and is conserved, so we subtract off the charge. And I think what we are doing by doing what we are doing by subtracting out this charge is effectively we are taking a transformation on the symplectic structure that doesn't preserve the structure, and we are projecting it down to some convergent phase space. And the resulting transformation may be very non-trivial. Maybe it's not even a gauge symmetry. So in that sense, this actually, when spelled out, this may fall into the category of not being a gauge symmetry. So an outlier.
Similar yeah. to what happens with like super translations of higher D, right? Where you're artificially adding in more like, gauge
And then I guess you can keep doing this. Like, so there's the linear in R, but quadratic. How high your order can be?
I think they could keep going because I thought that the special feature for this guy was that the leading guy that was like overleading part could be subtracted in terms of the previous word identity.
Right, but right. So we don't keep going because we don't know how to subtract off the subleading part. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But this is all at tree level.
About charges also.
Yes, sorry.
Symmetries.
So basically, when they have phase space, and then they've decided to like by hand, like you just add in pure like gauge transformations that are more and more overleading. And in the case of the subleading guy,
but wouldn't that change the field of the fields?
Exactly. Right. So that's the question mark. Like you have a phase space that you've like ironed down, and now you're adding on top of that extra large gauge transformation. It seems very weird to do.
But we cannot keep enlarging the space of fields. At some point, it's not going to be a symplectic manifold.
Exactly. So. But apparently, there's somehow the partner of it is subleading soft.
Yeah, so subleading tree-level soft theorem. Yes. But yeah, so maybe this has to do with the fact that the subleading or the divergent large gauge transformations don't have as a good status as super rotations in terms of asymptotic symmetry. So
is this an important part what would follow, so is this an aside?
This would be an aside. Well, I guess ultimately this should be short sorted out, but for what I'm gonna talk about next, this is not an important part.
Okay.
Yeah. No. So that point about keeping the symplectic structure is not what I'm gonna talk about. But that ultimately has to be sorted out. But the reason people don't seem to be too worried about that is because people seem to use this as a stepping stone to go to gravity. And in gravity, super rotations don't have this thickness. Well, they have singularities, but not of this type.
And also universal.
And also universality. Yeah, super rotations are universal, but the divergent large gauge transformations are not. Okay, so I'll briefly review what the divergent large gauge transformations are, and then we will be looking at the loop corrections to this.
No,
that particular point was not important.
Can I make a comment, actually? In what they did, the computer data, they've shown that the symplectic space factorizes when they add stuff. So it's actually the symplectic space without the adding plus this place with the adding, if you choose a very specific bracket, which was actually a technical point in their works. So in that case, it kind of worked, right? You can think of it as really separated sectors. The thing that is kind of subtle is that eventually they related it to the subleading theorem, which is on the original basis. So that's the thing. Like they added together at 1+1 and then one vector reacted on the
and then the introduction at bigger symmetry that rotates
exactly on the region. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So I guess all the comment by a specific parameter is this form. So yeah, we consider a gauge transformation where the gauge parameter is at large R linear order in R. And then if you work in Lorentz gauge, this parameter should solve the Lorentz gauge condition. And this fixes all the subleading terms to be this form. So the leading term should be U independent. And then the second term should be linear in U, and it goes on. The third term should be quadratic in U, cubic in U, and so on. But the subleading terms are, they go to zero as R goes to infinity. So that's why I wrote the parameter up to here. One subtlety is that when solving this equation at each order in 1 over R, there is an integration constant coming along. Those have to do with the large gauge transformations that correspond to the leading soft theorem, and therefore we set those to zero. So this parameter, if we compute the generator of this gauge symmetry, what we find is that it takes this particular form on a constant time slice. So there is a time multiplying the convergent large gauge transformation charge with parameter lambda. And what this means is that this charge, if we write down the wired identity, will give you the leading soft theorem. And then there's a bunch of other stuff on the time slice. And the logic of the authors is that this charge we know is conserved. It gives you this leading soft theorem, so we subtract it off. And we want to see what the remainder does as a wired identity.
Multiplied by time, right?
Sorry?
It's conserved, but it's multiplied by time.
It's, yeah, the thing multiplied by time, and this time is infinite. That's the thing, because R goes to infinity.
I think the notion of conservation is confusing because you're saying like there's a time equation, so we just care about stripping off like a n equals out, and that's R.
So we have to subtract out R instead of T. So yes, there is a problem here. So here they use constant time slice, but actually when you repeat this procedure entirely at the so what they do is they start from a time-like slice, and then they ultimately go to null slice by keeping U fixed and sending R to infinity. But if you actually start from working on a null slice, there is a difference. And the difference is that in order for things to work out, in order for this whole story to work out at null slices, this one should be gone. And then everything's fine, except for the fact that that parameter no longer satisfies the Lorentz gauge condition. And that's why this procedure only seems to work in Lorentz gauge. And even then, we have the problem of like, well, shouldn't we keep R fixed, not T? So there's still some discrepancies here. So people who work on null slices have parameters without this one. People who work with the time, like the constant time slices, have this one, but this still hasn't been sorted out, as far as I understand. But yeah.
But why is picking a gauge important? I mean, shouldn't you
just
think without picking a gauge?
Exactly, I would side with that opinion. Fixing, when you say fixing a gauge, wait, you know, when you say, well, whatever gauge we work in, it's not important. On the boundary, like the gauge transformations are no longer redundancies. So even the gauge transformations that take one configuration in Lorentz gauge to outside of it should still be a valid asymptotic symmetry. So from that point of view, I would side with the people who do this on the null slice. It's just that now there on the null slice, you get exactly the same results, but with this T replaced by R. So,
but you still have one in the H charts. Like if you read the different H charts, the condition is not clear if you have exactly the residual symmetry. So there seems to be something very
Right, but if you no longer impose, so if you say we don't impose a gauge condition,
yeah,
not just work with a different gauge, then it doesn't really matter if the one is there or not, right?
No, but I'm saying it's not clear to me that if you try to, if you pick non-harmonic gauge, that you would find. These charges, so there shouldn't, the physics shouldn't change.
The physics shouldn't change, but if you actually try this with a temporal gauge, for instance, I don't think you have a parameter that works.
Exactly. So in temporal gauge, you don't have
this transformation.
Where it's something that's supposed to be universal software. So like, is there a sense in which the physics is coming from something that you?
Why do you need to pick a gauge?
Right, harmonic.
Yeah.
Why do you need to pick a gauge?
Exactly. That's why I'm saying there's something weird that in this construction you wouldn't have it if you picked a different gauge.
No. Why do you?
Just not pick a gauge at all.
Physics is that you have something, you're varying the boundary by you lambda.
So if I repeat this procedure at null infinity and have a gauge parameter that doesn't respect Lorentz gauge conditions, I would say that's fine. But
I would not have the leading over, you would just do a variation.
Oh, no, I would say I pick this parameter, and this parameter, the generator of that gauge symmetry would give you the subleading soft theorem.
Perhaps it's not something you're going to do, and it's something somebody else did. We might like it or not, but it's irrelevant for the talk, so perhaps you can just move on.
I don't think it's relevant because you've worked
a lot. Just one comment, sorry. The problem is that we're calling gauge two things that are different, right? There is one thing which is a true gauge, which is the residual guy, and there's one thing that is not a gauge, which is the guy that has an associated charge on phase space.
Yes.
The point is that in front of that one, you put an alpha, and you make that alpha part of your phase space, so you allow alpha to vary, delta alpha different than zero. Is Q alpha zero? If it is zero, then what Davide say is absolutely correct. You should not depend by that one, you could put it to zero at will. But if Q alpha is not zero, then this is not gauge.
Exactly.
And
even if the parameter doesn't satisfy the gauge condition that you are working in the bulk, and it would turn out that Q of alpha would be non-zero, and that is physical. So I would say that's a perfectly valid asymptotic symmetry generator of the theory.
Well, then in that case, it's not gauge. So then you shouldn't even ask yourself what does happen if I change it, because it's not gauge. It's like working with mass 3 or mass 7. I mean,
no, but the sense in which you wouldn't figure out that you should be measuring the quantity in the scene, the already picked harmonic gauge, and then look for the space.
So I guess it's shared. Can we just keep going with the seminar? And we have discussions on things done by other people, not relevant to the what you're doing. If he says you don't like this, it means you want to do something else. So just tell us.
So what I want to say is that, what I want to put out there is that this way of working with constant time slices has controversies. But if you work with null slices, it still works out fine. It's just that the gauge condition is not satisfied, which I would imagine Alok will have problems with, but I wouldn't. Okay. So this remainder thing. Now, if we go to null infinity by keeping u fixed, the retarded time fixed, and then sending time to infinity, we would get the following expression in terms of the current and the gauge field. Here, the number on top of the fields referred to how fast the coefficient of in the 1 over r expansion. So for instance, the 2 Ja would mean the 1 over r squared coefficient of Ja. Now, if you take this charge and sandwich it as a Wardian entity with the scattering matrix, then you can see that this you can show that this is equivalent to the tree-level subleading soft theorem, which has been done by people, including Sabrina, quite some time ago. Now, okay. So in this sense, the divergent large gauge transformations with this specific parameter corresponds to the tree-level subleading soft theorem. Now, if you go to loops, and this has first been done by Sue Byrne, Davis, and Noel. The subleading soft tree level subleading soft theorem receives corrections when you go to loops. And what it looks like is the following. You have the usual leading soft theorem, and then you have the subleading soft theorem, plus there is an infinite factor, and this infinity comes from IR divergence. So this is very weird because we thought we have already factored out the dependence of the external soft photon, but in this expansion, the remaining thing, if you compute loops, there's still something IR divergent about this factor. And a similar construction has been done by Ashok Sen and Sahu, I guess 1 or 2 years later. And what they argued was that if you don't impose a power law series, but rather include non-analytic terms, such as log omega, or omega log omega, and higher powers of logs, then you no longer get this type of 1 over epsilons. What you get is a perfectly finite series that includes logarithms. So now, in one loop, the amplitude with the photon in the limit where the photon energy goes to zero has the divergent leading soft part. And then there's something that sits in between, which is also divergent, but logarithmically. And this term here is usually called the log soft theorem, or the log corrected soft theorem. And the soft factor looks like this for QED. And you can see that it's quite different from the tree-level subleading soft factor, or the leading soft factor, in that it's quite more complex. This becomes even more complex for perturbative quantum gravity.
In higher loop, are we expected to see higher powers of log?
Yes. So in two loops, I think you usually get 1 more power of log. And this goes on.
This was massless or massive?
So this can be done for both massless and massive.
You have a log?
Yes, you have a log. So
if I add a massive electrons to these photons, I'll get a log?
It's the log of the photon energy. And if you have massive electrons, you get an additional classical part. So here, what I mean by classical is that this soft factor, there's two lines here. The Ashok Sen and Sahu call the first line the classical part of the soft factor, and the second line the quantum part. And the reason they make this differentiation is because the second part actually comes from loop computations in Feynman diagrams, but the first part comes from not from loops, but this comes from what you call the Fadeev-Kulis dressings, or the long-range interactions of the theory. So an intuitive way of thinking of the classical part is if you look at the subleading soft factor, it had an angular an orbital angular momentum part. And if you look at the trajectories of particles in gauge theory, you would a naive way of thinking of it is that at long distances, you have no interactions, so they're free fields. But that's not true, because the interactions usually fall off as 1 over time, and there's a log correction to the straight line trajectories. So if you now take that into account, and compute the orbital angular momentum of the corrected trajectories, you get an expression like this.
So what is it in the gravitational case? Like, you still have the equivalent dressing effects and stuff there, right?
Yes. So in gravity, you'd have the first line and the second line. Yeah. It'll just have more factors of the momentum instead of the charges. Okay, and this log soft factor is conjectured to be universal. Recall that the tree-level subleading soft factor was not universal for QED, but here, even for QED, like this factor is conjectured to be universal. This is still being sorted out. The original authors have tried computing, doing this computation both for QED and for gravity. Well, not for for electromagnetism and gravity with non-minimal couplings. And everything they have tried so far, they get exactly this. But of course, that doesn't mean they have proven universality. That means that there is supporting evidence that this may be universal. But this is very recent. Like I think the non-minimal coupling paper came out like 2 months ago. So this is still in the works.
This is a property of photons in the presence of massive particles, for example.
Photons in the presence of massive particles, yes.
So I can just replace massive particles by Wilson lines or something like that, right? So it must be universal.
Yes, I think what they, and by they, I mean Sahu and others, yeah. Nara Shok Sen. And I think what they have tried is just electromagnetism with non-minimal coupling, like maybe like adding
other corrections. Yeah. Okay.
But I don't think Wilson lines have been tried. Okay. So what is going to be the topic of the remainder of the talk is the trying to answer the question of what the asymptotic symmetry corresponding to this soft theorem is. And we work with a specific example, which is massive scalar QED. And we work with massive because we really want to capture the classical part as well. If you go to massless theories, you get this type, but just the second line. There's no classical part to massless electrons. Okay, so just to set up the notation, we work with two coordinate systems. One is tau rho, there is ur. Tau rho is the coordinates for the massive particles. If we take tau to infinity, we follow the future trajectory of the massive electrons. And for if we take u to infinity, sorry, if we take r to infinity, that corresponds to the future trajectory of massless particles. Okay, so if we take tau to infinity, that is, follow the future trajectory of electrons, what one usually does is that you say at infinity there's no interactions, they are free fields, so we solve the Klein-Gordon equation and then work with the solutions. Now, if you actually look at this equation in gauge theory, instead of the Nabla squared, you'd get covariant derivative squared, and if you write that out, as an expansion in 1 over tau, what you see is that it has a Klein-Gordon part plus a correction that goes like 1 over tau. And if you solve this corrected equation, what you get is not the space of free scalar fields, but rather the free scalar fields multiplied by tau of some phase. And here, the one above a tau means it's the coefficient in 1 over tau expansion. So this a tau really falls off as 1 over tau. And you can see that if I write this as an exponential, there's a log tau associated to it. And that will be the culprit of everything that comes afterwards in terms of logs of omega. Now, we have logarithms in the solution of massive electrons. And this introduces logarithmic terms to gauge fields and field strength as well via the Maxwell equations. So for instance, if we look at some components of the field strength, you can see that there's log r's that wouldn't have been there if we worked with free fields. And also the gauge fields will have log r corrections. This fr of a is weird in the sense that it not only gets corrections, but it also gets something that is overleading to what you get with free fields. But this is not a problem, because if you look at the equations of motion with these modified falloffs, this term you will find is independent of time. It is a free parameter that you can fix and fixing this to a number would be equivalent to fixing a boundary condition. So you can fix this to zero. And that's what we do.
Can I just add to that?
Yes.
Okay. So in the previous slide, you're looking at incentive solutions to box by zero, you can make covariant version of that. And then now that'll change some like log follows the scalar field. Here, I guess you're looking at if you had that scalar field with those follows, what currents they would source, and then the log terms are sourced here. But
yes.
You're not actually solving anything, you're just looking at the phase basically.
Yes, I am looking at, well, I am solving the Maxwell equation. Just in terms of fall off. So if the
should be written like what is the source? The source gonna be a fixed like scalar field.
The source would be the scalar field at time like infinity. Yeah. So you can match those in terms of these fields at the future boundary of null infinity. Okay. Now that 1/tau correction not only gives log r's, but it also gives log u's in the large u limits. And two important quantities are follows. So the fr of a 2 here, and then a of 0 here. And we'll come back to this later. OK, so we now know that adding long-range interactions into account gives you logarithmic falloffs. So using these new falloffs, we reconsider the divergent large gauge transformation in Lorentz gauge. And if you're offended by Lorentz gauge, we can relax this and work straight with null boundaries. It's just that some numbers differ, but no conceptual difference there. OK, so the generator of this particular gauge transformation has two parts. It has a hard part written as an integral over the future boundary of null infinity, and a soft part written as an integral over the entire time, like null infinity.
And
sorry.
Is the divergent part not? You've stripped that off already.
No, this we will see that the divergent part is sitting inside here. But if you just look at this expression, there's nothing in particular that looks different from what you would have obtained using free fields. If you repeat this computation with free fields for massive charges, you would get exactly the same results. And by exactly, I mean in terms of expressions, you'd get f3 u of r, f2 u of r, and so on. So you could ask, like, well, have anything changed? Now, the Maxwell's equation tells us that the hard charge, the expressions, all the terms can be written in terms of fr of a2. And if we rewrite this, we get the divergence of FRA with some projector at large U. And large U because this is computed at U goes to plus infinity. So recall that the long-range interactions gave you a logarithm of U of FRA. And if you look at this projector, you'll see that this exactly kills the first term and picks up the second term. Now, if we have worked with free fields, we wouldn't have this log term, and this would have picked up the next term. Now, the difference between the subleading term and this term is that this is divergent in large U.
But would they have written it down in terms of like the matter currents before if they were doing like log label? Mm-hmm. Manipulation that any would do, sometimes you have logarithmic, like it's an R, you gotta replace the log part, where yes. You would source just like the current, so like in like ESP or sheet, like just the current.
Oh, you mean like why aren't the currents not
like
here?
You just plug in, like the current would be replacing the term you're saying.
Oh yes, that can be done the same way here. Like you can rewrite FRA in terms of currents on the time like infinity, but this would still remain. Like it'd pick up a divergent term, which probably would because we are working with time like infinity now. Yeah, it would be written in terms of tau rows. Actually, that's a story that still has to be figured out, and I'll come back to that later in the last slide. Okay, so the bottom line on this slide is that we take into account long-range interactions, and that introduces a new term picked up by the hard charge that makes it divergent. So I will remember this form for later. If we look at the soft charge, it had that particular form here. And this 1 over U term wasn't there when you work with free fields. It is introduced by taking into account long-range interactions. And this projector here, the U del of U, kills the first term and picks up the second term, just like in the hard charge. And by doing a little bit of gymnastics, you can rewrite that expression as a projector that is del U, U squared del U. And also, this extra term makes the whole charge divergent logarithmically. So collecting those two results, we find that the total charge becomes the following. So it has a logarithmically divergent term that has been regulated, and then plus finite terms. If you had worked with free fields, you would not get this divergent term, and you would have ended up with a finite charge. Now, what is interesting is that this square bracket here is exactly the logarithmic charge that has been proposed by Campiglia and Lada, whose Ward identity yields the logarithmic soft theorem. So a couple of years ago, these authors put this forth, saying if we just had a symmetry that gave you this charge, its Ward identity would give you the log soft theorem.
So you're basically saying if you're careful about the overloading charge, that's the standard one without trying to do the logos of log thing, and you look at the correct base space, you also find the charges that they by hand were trying to identify.
Exactly, yes. So, and those all come from just one fact. We are taking long-range interactions into account. Yes. So what this shows is that if we write down the Ward identity of this charge, it'll have a divergent part. And if we strip off the divergence and read off the coefficient, it'll give you the, as a Ward identity, it'll give you the log soft theorem. So what this shows is that there is a correspondence between divergent large gauge transformations with long-range interactions taken into account and the logarithmic soft theorems. And notice that in this expression here, the finite terms, you'd think, oh, well, isn't the tree-level subleading soft theorem hiding here? It is hiding there, but it is getting washed out by the finite terms that drop off from the this divergent term. So you can even say, like, once you take long-range interactions into account, the tree-level subleading soft theorem is no longer there. So more precisely, the charge that generates this particular linearly divergent gauge transformation has the following properties. If you work with free fields, it gives you the tree-level soft theorem. If you work with dressed fields, it gives you the loop-corrected soft theorems. And the asymptotic symmetry that corresponds to tree-level soft theorem leads to the same logarithmic soft theorems once long-range interactions are taken into account. Now,
sorry, in the loop,
yes?
In the soft theorem for the loop, you had the 1 over epsilon. What was that epsilon?
That epsilon was an infrared regulator, like a photon mass, that you have to make add to make the expressions finite.
So if the photon energy is finite, everything is finite, right?
Well, no. So that epsilon is not the external photon energy. Uh-huh. What you get is you get photon loops, and those still have infrared divergences that haven't been cured. And so you do like a dim rag, and that epsilon would be like the
so
4 minus epsilon.
If I'm careful about the H bars, shouldn't I be able to recognize the three-level subleading soft theorem as part of both three-level and a little bit of one loop and so on? Isn't there this common law that classical physics is hidden a little bit also inside the loops, but so it's three-level plus a little bit of each loop also contributes to this classical deflection of particles, for example. So
that's
it looks discontinuous. There is one over F, and then there is a log. How do I get?
So
it's
so it's log instead of one over F, so. I thought it was messed up. If you do the calculation properly, you get log.
So the 1 over epsilon.
So 1 over epsilon is not doing wrong, right?
It's doing no, it's not safe for asking a question. The first line was an infrared unsafe question, you shouldn't have asked it. And then the next line was an infrared safe question, which had the logo of Omega and was fine.
The second question is purely classical, right? So this is like describing classical massive particles which are charged. And
the classical part of the second.
And so on.
The second part has classical and quantum parts. The classical part was what I was describing in terms of the trajectories.
The log is for the classical part, right?
The log has both classical and quantum part. There were two lines. The second line was the quantum part that actually came from one of the computations.
Then I'm confused, sorry. So you are saying that this is there were two equations, they were different. Was one of them wrong?
No, the 1 over epsilon you can think of as log omega, but you wouldn't see it because you started out from imposing a power law for power series in omega.
But that sounds like a human choice, right? I mean, the result is the result. Is the correct result with log and the 1 over epsilon is wrong, or are both correct, but I need to interpret carefully? A wrong ansatz, we get wrong solutions.
Right, I would say you started with the wrong ansatz and then you...
That paper is wrong.
You started with assuming a power law series, which it's impossible to pick up a log term, right?
No, but what you're saying is that there's a physical, like, when you have the photon profile, the Fourier transform has a log in it, it doesn't, right? Like, that's not a mysterious question that I...
Is it impressive or is it not impressive?
Also, I guess this has to do with the fact that this log omega... where was it? So it has a log omega in front, but it actually has two origins. So this first term has a log omega, the second term as well. The second term actually is the log omega, the log of the external soft photon. The first term, how they derive this in the paper is that you get an expression like a log of inverse time as time goes to infinity in the scattering matrix. And they interpret that as the soft photon energy. I am not sure if the rewriting, like actually getting this result in terms of log of the soft photon energy has been done, but I am not aware.
It's a little bit of translation between a classical computation,
yes,
done more in position space with trajectories and
yes,
so on, and an amplitude computation that's done with momentum, and when we convert, one-to-one, but there are some small...
Exactly, so...
Those are what explain the 1 over epsilon versus the log.
Yes, in the classical computations, I don't think there has been an exact computation done with log omega. You get log of inverse time, and then you say the inverse time, the only scale it comes from is the external photon.
They try to worry
about it, and I think... Because time depends only the initial and final energy are not the same, so that must be the...
It must be the photon.
But you're getting this from amplitude, that you're computing this with some different EFTs, like not really graphical.
Yes. Yes, I don't know how it's computed, like how the classical part is computed in the paper 2 months ago, but in the original paper. Yes, in the original paper, they're computing it semi-classically.
And if you're trying to imagine they're consistent or they're not consistent, I would have thought they should be.
They are consistent, yeah. I mean, but if you ask, so if you take Swedburn's paper, the 1 over epsilon term, and if you look at the quantum part of this, do they agree? I don't know the answer to that question.
So for the subheading soft graviton example, my impression was like the loop corrected part of that is literally just coming from the like conal exchanges of like the loop correction.
If I remember correctly, though, it worked out pretty much the same way, both for photons and gravitons.
There's a claim that there's a universal one of correction to the subheading soft graviton thing.
Yes.
And then, like, Temple and others go up and turn it into an onset square correct. It's just a situation being subtracted back off.
Yes.
In that situation, that expansion never had a log of omega, as far as I was, like, staring at it.
Do they have one of epsilons?
Sure, the one who wraps on there is a cutoff in the
That's what I would think, but if in that case those two terms should agree, but I haven't done this matching.
So you're saying just like literally in that same expression, there's another term in the expansion that they just ignore because they didn't need it for the manipulations they're doing. You could actually have.
Yes. So it's my understanding that if you start from a power series,
yeah,
you will inevitably get a one over epsilon somewhere.
But I mean, the epsilon they know where it comes from, like
from the loop diagrams. Yes. Yes.
So like assuming a power series. They're doing
oh, no. Those loop diagrams only have to do with the second line here. They have nothing to do with the first line.
Sure.
Yeah. And those, this was for massive particles or massive?
No, they're doing, it would probably be massive.
I think all of these have been, like even Swedburn's paper have been done in massless particles. And in massless particles, you don't see the semi-classical parts. So these are actually like loop computations. No trajectories or anything.
Yeah, so you're saying that when like Andy and friends are extracting like the higher divergent part,
mm-hmm.
they might have been suppressing something that has a lot of omega.
I would think so, yes. And I think that was one of the points that Ashok Sen was making when doing this log omega.
Sure, but I think when he was making that point, it wasn't clear that that's all they were dropped, like that literally the same terms would appear in
the two. Yeah, exactly. So do the coefficients agree? I don't know.
If they agree, then you have a word in any for the one, and probably.
Yes. Yeah, I haven't seen anywhere that shows it agrees, but
But this has to be nice because like the kind of combination of like these two brushes is
bad. You have 5 minutes for 10 slides. So.
Oh, yeah. So I just have one more slide. Yeah.
I'm not.
Okay, I've got this.
No. So the thing is, it's not done yet, and therefore it's a work in progress. So. One thing is that, as Sabrina mentioned, this hard charge, which was written as an integral over the sphere, it is known that this can be rewritten as an expression over a three-dimensional integral on the time like infinity. So here, you see that there's a phi squared, which is the density operator of the charge. And then there's the a tau. But this a tau is not a free gauge field. It's sourced by the matter fields, which means that this charge is not quadratic in the matter fields, but it's quartic. So if you had the phase space of free fields, this charge would have an algebra that doesn't close. So that means we should have something better. And we are still working through this, but we think the answer is to work with a phase space of dressed matter fields. And I think very recently, like 2-3 weeks ago, there was a paper that does this in gravity with dressed fields, and they succeed in doing rederiving the charge at time like infinity. So we think we're on the right track, but then what is the action on the phase space? This still has to be worked out, and that's the hard side. On the soft side, we had a divergent gauge transformation, but we sort of waved away the actual divergent part by saying, oh, it's the leading soft theorem, it's known. But what we are doing by doing so is that we are projecting down to a phase space of convergent fields. And this projector, we don't know if it has nice properties, maybe not. And it may as well be that the induced action on the convergent phase space is no longer a gauge transformation. So this is something that still has to be spelled out. But in gravity, if we repeat this procedure, we will be working with super rotations, and those are perfectly well-defined. So, well-defined on the given phase space. What the phase space is still on the works. But the problem will be less severe, let's say. And what is the celestial CFT generator? This will have impact on the celestial holography, because usually the soft factors are some residues of poles on integral conformal weights. But if you have a log soft factor, it'll be the residue of a double pole at zero conformal weight. And what that means is because it's a double pole, it'll wash out the residue of the simple pole at zero conformal weight, which is the subleading tree-level soft theorem. And this still has to be understood, but this is what we are thinking about right now. So yeah, that is it. Thank you.
Any questions?
Transformation is inducing some fields leading on the.
What do you mean by higher order? Like which direction?
Overleading.
Overleading, like R squared. It's
like in the usual setup, there are works by Hendel.
Yes.
Showing that you can write down these extra terms as modes leading on squared, that their own internal dynamics that you cannot predict.
Mm-hmm.
In this sense, are left over of the gauge transformation.
Yes.
But all. For the leading in R, not for the overleading. And then Campilla and Peraza have a paper in which they discussed that a bit, but I was wondering whether in your framework you thought of this as attributes.
So it is my understanding in that paper of Campilla and Lada that they try R squared. So they first try R, and it gives you this subleading soft theorem. They try R squared, and they don't know what to subtract out. Like so in the R case, we know that the divergent part, we could relate it to the leading soft theorem. But in the R square case, that wasn't clear. So that's where they stopped. We haven't thought about that direction, but I think it's in the same status. And people, well, I guess some people, for instance, including Prahar, are skeptical in working with divergent transformations in the first place. That would be like a red flag because you will ultimately have to project it down to some convergent phase space, and then who knows what that action is. And this will...
You might say it's a book keeping the box, right?
Yes.
In simple setups, it has been shown to be dual to the pseudo-vectors that Ranzetti have defined, which are finite, but they are integral along the graph, instead of being over. You can always trade an R derivative by a U. Right? So either you overlead or you start integrating instead of deriving and then computing charges for things that are not vectors, become computing charges, kind of tricky.
I see.
So I'm just saying it's a bookkeeping device.
I would agree that it's a good great way to look at things. It's just that there are things to spell out at the end of the day. Yeah.
To what extent are you not just looking at higher moments of the equations of motion and then you're going to be able to play? And you never talk about our students and you can get understand why you're
trying to get other sources of information. Yeah, that was also the original discussion of Perros, that you take a fine Gordon color field and standardize it.
Any other questions to the speaker?
You have any seriously
going
to be?
Hello?
Okay.
The speaker was whether or not you can just keep going without working, you just plug in the equations of motion that you expect to hold for your conserved current with the appropriate boundary conditions and try it on amplitudes higher and harder order.
And without even looking at, without looking at gauge transformations.
Yeah.
That's one other way to approach this, yes. And that would actually not, we don't have to deal with the like divergent R stuff in the first.
And then you could go to each, like, so I guess in that situation, would you know, like, the results from the teacher, you know how to go to some somebody more in that context? You don't have any something, which would be the
obstruction to study. People say that you can do this. I don't exactly know how you can work this out. Like, actually, for instance, like, some people would say, well, why don't you just compute the modified phase space first, and you have the expression for the charge, so you just work out the action on the field.
I was surprised that you said that there's an amplitude result that log term in the subleading software is universal in this class of theory, so they're checking. Like, I wouldn't
yes.
know how subleading in omega would be universal still.
Mm-hmm.
Like, my intuition would have actually probably got it because I didn't know our gauge transformation interpretation.
Right.
So.
I think the claim, not the proof, is that you have the subleading soft theorem gets a universal log correction.
Yeah.
Sub-subleading has also log square omega term that's universal, and that's two loop exact. And sub leading has higher orders in log that's universal, and so on.
Okay, so maybe another question would be, say I just take the, say I think my equations of motion here is right, mm-hmm. doing the moments at what point do I have quantity, I don't have a value of the gas in my space. Like for example, mm-hmm. for the leading and subleading subdivision gravity, I have a bonding mass that I really didn't have.
I don't know. I'll have to think about this, but I haven't thought about it.
So I have a question online.
Sure.
I could not follow all the discussion, but it's Laurent. Hello, sorry, Mark. Maybe it what was discussed, but because here he presented the picture of this divergent gauge transformation, but later, especially the work we did with Anna and Daniele, we showed that you can recover these subleading, sub-subleading symmetries as proper symmetry, of the asymptotic phase space. They don't have to be divergent at all. They're kind of non-local, for sure. So there's really kind of two different perspectives on it that needs to be, of course, reconciled.
Yes.
In the end of the day, you get exactly the same charges, but there's no divergence in that approach.
Oh, yes. So I think what we are doing here, even though we are working with divergent stuff, we are actually modding out the divergent part of it. And at the end of the day, everything has to be convergent. But it's just that in this context, it's the keeping the divergent part intact is a nice bookkeeping device.
Okay.
But I would imagine what I'm referring to
is that there is higher order conservation equations, like the generalized Bondi and the other ones that are asymptotic equations of motions whose conservation laws are leads to new charges, right? So you can do that completely at sky. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and that would have to agree with what we would get from here after modding things out. Yes, but I don't
exactly
think that has been explicitly worked out, like the connection between this and that. But
yeah. I mean, you get the same charge for sure, but the explicit connection. There is one paper that connects the two that connects these. You know, we can chat about it. In the gravity case.
In the gravity, okay.
Can I ask a question?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So you showed that the behavior of the fields changed after you accounted for these back reactions. For this logarithmic term, there was some extra log term in the fields at infinity. Gauge transformations would call logarithmically at infinity instead of linearly.
Ah, so basically simulating what we did here, but with gauge transformations.
Yeah, exactly. Gauge transformations call logarithmically.
Maybe. But in that case, the coefficient, so here, not only that, the important part was that, one, it had a log tau phase, to the coefficient of the log tau was the something sourced by the matter fields. But in that case, I think you'd only get the log tau, but not the sourced part. So maybe that won't be as interesting as this case. But I haven't looked at gauge transformations that go like log tau. Actually, if you map this to I plus, the gauge parameter goes like tau, not log tau. So maybe there's some interesting thing to look at log tau order. But this hasn't been done yet.
Any other questions? I'd like to speak again.
Thank you.